I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. If you're a parent of a school-aged child, you must be feeling whiplashed when it comes to the issue of masks. In January, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy declared a public health emergency because of the Omicron variant, extending his mask mandate for all school children. This past Monday, he lifted that mandate starting in March because of a big drop in COVID-19 cases. In fact, he said, we have to learn how to live with COVID as we move from a pandemic to the epidemic phase of this virus. Other Democratic governors are making the same decision, including Delaware Governor Carney. Pennsylvania Governor Wolf lifted the school mask mandate in January. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics is not on board, nor is the CDC. Here's CDC Director Dr. Rachel Walensky speaking yesterday about the agency's next steps.
Yes, we are prepared. We are working on that guidance. We are working on, you know, following the trends for the moment. What I will say, though, is, you know, our hospitalizations are still high. Our death rates are still high. So as we work towards that and as we are encouraged by the current trends, we are not there yet.
In other news, the scientific advisors to the FDA will decide next week whether to greenlight two doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine for children ages 6 months to 4 years. We have a lot to talk about, and we have two guests who have joined us. David Rubin is director of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's Policy Lab. He's also a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. David Rubin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us and joining us by Skype is Jennifer Nazzo. She's an epidemiologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. She's also a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Jennifer Nazzo, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Nice to have you both with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. We have so much to talk about. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. David Rubin, if you were the governor of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or Delaware, would you lift the mask mandate for school children?
Yeah, I think we have to understand what exactly is happening right now. I think, you know, our public health departments, as well as our CDC, is still recommending and encouraging people to wear masks, including students and staff in schools, until case incidence comes down. I think what's happening right now is a discussion of whether we need to continue to require this as a matter of public order. And what you're seeing now is a shift in responsibility to individuals to make these choices. And I think when that happens, it's still incumbent upon schools to inform families what recommendations are of local health departments. But we're returning choices to individual families who are considering a number of challenges and competing risks in how they make the decision about whether their kids are going to go to school with masks on.
Jennifer, no, so I mean, that's a big choice for a parent to make. How do you decide? How do you decide if where you live and the school that your child attends is safe to unmask?
Sure, it is a big decision, but it's also one that parents have been making, maybe not in terms of how they send their children to school, but just in terms of what levels of exposure they've been willing to give their children when they're not in school. And when you look at the epidemiology of where kids are getting sick, for a lot of this pandemic, it's largely been things that aren't in schools. So I think we have to acknowledge the decision-making that parents do. Obviously, you know, one hopes that they sort of look at the risk in the communities where they live. They also have a sense of what other measures their schools are taking to make their children safer. But also, it's also going to come down to some extent, individual family circumstances and the level of risk tolerance that different families have. You know, if a family has already had COVID and everybody's vaccinated, you know, that's a different consideration going forward than a family who has neither had COVID or may not be vaccinated or has living with them particularly vulnerable relatives. And I think that's where it's hard to say this is what everybody should do, but recognize the fact that different families have different circumstances and will make different decisions.
Well, let me pick up on that. And David Rubin, go back to you. So let's say you've got families who are making different decisions about whether their child can safely go to school masked or unmasked. If you have a class of let's say, vulnerable children that maybe have a vulnerable parent or grandparent at home, or maybe have some risk for contracting COVID, or maybe they're not vaccinated at all, can we mix children up in the same classroom safely?
I think absolutely. I think, you know, another consideration right now is we're watching case incidents decline very quickly. Hospitalizations are recovering, and in our own program here in the Philadelphia region, where we're screening teachers weekly with tests, we're seeing a rate of about 1 in 500 right now, which is the lowest rate we've seen in the entire school year thus far. So very quickly, the exposure risk has gone down. And so, given that we have a lower exposure risk, we have masks available to children and staff who may choose to continue to wear them, and vaccinations and boosters for those who are eligible. I think there's a sufficient level of protection to allow folks more flexibility around their choices.
And Jennifer Nussel, going back to New Jersey, I was looking at when Governor Murphy extended the mask mandate, and this was back in January, and we saw just the most extraordinary spike of this Omicron virus, and then we see it just plummet, you know, down to where it is today. And I'm not a scientist. Most parents are not scientists. You look at that, and it's like, how do we comprehend that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Omicron was really challenging for a lot of places. But, you know, in terms of teasing out what, if anything, the masks did, and I think they helped. I think when we look to other settings like, you know, Hong Kong, for instance, where there's very high level of compliance with masking, and yet they're still going through one of the largest surges of cases that they've had to date. I think what we're seeing is that Omicron has infected a lot of people, and it has left a lot of immunity in its wake. And when you see the case numbers come down that quickly, you have to assume that immunity has played a large part in that. It doesn't mean that, you know, we're done there. You know, if anyone hasn't gotten the virus, you know, they're still, vulnerable to it. And that includes people who are vaccinated, though they're less vulnerable to it. The thing that we have to pay attention to is, as David said, looking at where we are most worried in terms of continued growth in cases, which, you know, is not at the state level many places right now, though individual communities may be experiencing different trends. And I think it's important to look below just the kind of high level statistics of a given state. But I think lost in this whole debate about schools and kids and masks is that, you know, many of the places that I am personally most worried about, mm-hmm. places that, you know, have very low and particularly lower than average vaccination coverage, masking hasn't been used in those places for a long time. You know, that they've already made that decision. And it seems like the places that are being discussed right now are the places that are much, much further down on my worry list.
Well, and we're talking about that states that had a mask mandate, and now governors are deciding that we can, you know, get rid of them essentially in the next couple of weeks. Let me go back to you then, David Rubin, and raising this question of masking. Here we are 2 years into the pandemic, and I'm asking this question, but nonetheless, how effective are masks at protecting children from getting COVID? Do we know?
Well, you know, we have some studies that we're doing here that will hopefully, you know, through peer review later in the year, but we have another study coming out next week as well, too. You know, we take it from a position of masks are very effective. I mean, we've seen it in our own hospitals. There are studies out there. The CDC reviews a number of those studies, and there'll be further studies upcoming that will review the safety of masks. They depend on how well the individual is wearing those masks, for sure. When we have periods of fatigue and poor compliance with masks, you know, the masks don't work as well. So, you know, we know what can work with regards to masks. But this is a moment now where it's not about whether masks work. We should accept that masks actually work. This is really a question of whether we need to require that everyone wear masks as part of a public health emergency to eliminate all exposure risk. And I think that's a distinction that's important, that we have the opportunity now to recognize that we can transition to families making these choices now more responsibly on their own, based on their own circumstances and their own calculus of risk.
Jennifer, and so picking up on, again, I'm going back and forth between the two of you, but apparently the death rate from the Omicron, or largely, I guess, Omicron variant today is something like 2,500 people are dying from coronavirus, largely the elderly, the medically vulnerable, and the unvaccinated. But when you look at children, I mean, children are really, I think only 25% of children 5 to 11 are vaccinated. So does that put children in a high-risk category?
Well, I think we have to be clear that one of the blessings of this pandemic is that children haven't been harder hit. Now, obviously, any child who loses life is an utter tragedy, and children are not supposed to die. But I, as a parent, am so grateful that I have to worry less about my children than I do my elderly relatives. You know, obviously, I worry about my elderly relatives, but, you know, I can't imagine how much harder this virus would have been if we were losing our children in the same level that we, you know, just anyway, that would just magnify the tragedy. Children are, it is, you know, at low risk for severe outcomes. I think we have to be clear about that. There's not no risk. And, you know, clearly when you have large numbers of cases and you apply even a very, very small percentage of those cases that will likely experience severe illness. When you apply a small percentage to a very large number, you get a substantial number, and we should absolutely try to prevent that. I think, you know, I'm, as a parent of two school-age children, I'm grateful that I was able to get them vaccinated because it just took another worry off of my list. I wasn't particularly paranoid about COVID in terms of severe outcomes for them, but now I am glad that I am basically taking that worry off of my list. I think we have to do more to reach parents. I can say that I have talked to a lot of parents who they themselves are vaccinated and they haven't yet got their children vaccinated. And I think we have to have conversations with them about their residual hesitancy. And for many of the parents that I've spoken to, it's based on a false perception that there may be long-term consequences from the vaccines that while they are willing to accept them on behalf of their own lives, are not willing to make that decision for people who are so early in their own lives. And I think we have to, you know, reset that belief, which we very much don't expect to be something that needs to be worried about.
Yeah, and we're almost up in a break here. So, David, I don't want to interrupt you, but at the same time, when you look at currently the hospital beds at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, are you seeing a lot of pediatric patients with COVID?
Actually, our numbers are back down to where they were in the fall. We've seen about an 80 to 90% reduction in hospitalizations. And even when we were at our peak, and there was a period of time when Pennsylvania and the Philadelphia region was near the leaders in the country in pediatric hospitalizations, we reviewed the spectrum of illness. And what we saw with Omicron was a lower spectrum of illness overall. Even within our hospitalized patients, we were seeing fewer children going to the ICU. And we were seeing a spectrum of illness that was consistent with other seasonal viruses that we often hospitalize children for in wintertime, including influenza and some other seasonal respiratory viruses as well, too. So, you know, in that context, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, our leadership and policy lab put out a statement because there was a lot of anxiety about when the numbers of children were in the hospital.
And David, I'm going to have to interrupt you only because we're up on a break, but we'll pick up on that after this very short break. Do stay with us. Everybody, we'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Governors across the country, including here in the tri-state area, are lifting or have lifted mask mandates for school children. We're talking about what you need to know about how to protect children from COVID, talking about masks, and we'll be talking about vaccines as well. And again, our guests are David Rubin. He's director of CHOP's Policy Lab. That's Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, also a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And as always on Radio Times, you can join our conversation by emailing us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call 1-888-477-9499. David, you were talking about the hospital beds at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and kind of where things stand today for children.
Yeah, you know, we were just pointing out that even though the numbers went up, and I think people were alarmed by the numbers of children that were in the hospital over the holiday season, the spectrum of illness was very similar for us that as we see with other seasonal viruses. In fact, our census did not change very much, and it was as if COVID replaced other seasonal viruses in terms of some of the typical seasonal illnesses that we see. We did have some children in the ICU, though, and, you know, they were largely representative of children who were unvaccinated. And to your point about vaccination, you know, what I'm concerned about now is that as we are improving, that people will say, see, I got through it, and we don't need to vaccinate our children. And so many kids had just had Omicron. And there's a couple of caveats or asterisks that families need to know as they are still making decisions about vaccinating their children. Number one is that, you know, early evidence on Omicron, it's a very different virus than some of the earlier versions of the virus that were much more severe. And it's not clear that infection with Omicron confers the same level of protection against those earlier forms. And when you hear public health experts concerns about the next variant, it's likely one to come off of the Delta variant, which was much more significant. And the most important reason to continue with vaccination and to continue to advocate for those in children is because what you really want protection against is not milder disease. It's against those variants that can cause severe disease and have some of the features that were in the vaccine to begin with. And so, you know, we're strongly encouraging families to get children vaccinated here through the spring. We're going to see COVID again. We're likely going to see it again next fall and winter through some level of seasonal resurgence. We don't know about further variants. And like I said, the Delta variant is a concern out there for a lot of folks who follow this closely in terms of something, a new variant coming off of that lineage, if you will. And so I think there's an opportunity right now to educate a lot of families of the importance of moving kids towards vaccination, including the younger kids when the vaccine is available for them.
We got people with questions, and I do want to get to them. Jennifer Nuzzolo, let me go back to you and something you said earlier, which was you worried more about your elderly family members than your children when it came to contracting the coronavirus. Is there something about a young person's immune system that is just better protects them against a virus such as coronavirus?
Well, I think the issue is really specific to COVID and the fact that the single biggest predictor of severe illness to date has been age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we see even people who are vaccinated that have experienced severe illness, it is often people of advanced age. So, children, I don't want to give the impression that children are always fine from respiratory viruses.
Sure.
And as David pointed out, that's not the case. They do wind up in the hospitals, and there are many other viruses that we particularly worry about. I can remember taking my infant son to the hospital on Christmas Day with RSV. That was a particularly scary experience. But I am fortunate that we haven't seen those same patterns play out quite as strongly with COVID. And, you know, certainly now that vaccines are available, that really helps take the worry off of many parents' lists. I do have to point out, because I hear from parents a lot who have children who are too young to be vaccinated. I know many of them are still sort of at home and worrying and wondering what to do, and many of them feel sort of forgotten in all of this. But I think the age, the fact that I mean, we have to just acknowledge that the deaths are not shared. The risk of death is not shared equally within all age groups.
Right. I hear what you're saying, and I also hear your caution in saying it. And you know, no one lives a risk-free life. And I guess it's a question of figuring out how much risk we're willing to take for ourselves and for our children. Let me read a comment from Conrad, who says, for much of the pandemic, public health experts have said masks are absolutely necessary, leading to many fights. Now we're hearing public health experts suddenly shift to personal choice. This seems to be not public health, but a political compromise between doing nothing and doing what is most protective. And I wonder, David Rubin, if you could speak to that. Let me just also say, I saw a Pew poll that something like 60% of Americans are just confused by these changing public health recommendations. Can you speak to Conrad's concern?
Well, number one, this has been a dynamic pandemic. And when the facts change, I think our recommendations need to change as well, too, in both directions. When, you know, when a severe variant emerges, or when a milder variant on average, like Omicron, or an assessment of population immunity from natural infection or vaccination would lead us to a different conclusion. There's also a seasonality to this. So I think it's important that, you know, recommendations can change over time. But I think that, you know, the perspective we need to have is not whether the public health recommendations are changing or whether this is political or not. It's whether we're in a public health emergency that requires public orders, to require that actually mandates the actions that people must follow, versus using public health recommendations to inform individuals how to protect themselves and their families in a larger calculus of risk that includes many factors. And I think that's the difference here, is that I fully embrace the CDC director's comments. Our local health departments, including in Philadelphia, which is likely to be more cautious than the outlying counties in terms of when they're going to roll back some of these requirements, because there's a smaller margin of error. Their goal is to inform the public of the best recommendations to reduce risk at the individual level. Politically, or, you know, from the perspective of the governor's office or the local leaders, the use of requirements is about a public health emergency. And I think that's the distinguishing feature. And I think what we're signaling now is the public health emergency is coming to an end, and we can rely on individuals to make choices on how to navigate their lives.
Jennifer Nuzzo, Brian says no one in this conversation has mentioned teachers and the risks that they face when the mask mandates are lifted. And I wonder if you could speak to that, about sort of how to find that place where children are safe, where teachers are safe, they can be together. I think we all think that they should be together in the classroom, but sort of mitigate, you know, how do we mitigate the various risks on both sides of the equation?
Yeah, I think it's a really important point. And, you know, I can say, you know, here is my wish for my child based on our family circumstances. What I can't tell you is, you know, what the circumstances are in the classroom, including what my children's teachers' wishes are. And I think that is absolutely important. I am very grateful that teachers have the ability to, and in many cases are required to, get vaccinated to protect themselves. But I also recognize that I want my children's teachers to feel safe. And part of that is having ensured that they are part of the conversations about when and how to lift mask mandates. And I think one of the big losses in all of this debate is that there hasn't been enough of sort of community input, including of the people who are going to be working day in and day out in the school systems. You know, I can tell my son's teacher, you know, my daughter's teacher, you know, here's what your risk likely is based on your circumstances. But at the end of the day, if they feel that they are not safe, or they feel like they're in the classroom under duress, that is not going to be a healthy situation for anybody. So we have to absolutely involve them in that decision making.
And that's Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Also with us is pediatrician David Rubin from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we are talking about children and COVID, what we all need to know, what we need to do to protect the children in our lives. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, You mentioned choice and parents, and you both talk about parents educating themselves and, you know, making a determination based on, you know, where they fit on the risk I guess, risk-reward level there. But there is so much misinformation and disinformation about COVID. Are you concerned that, that parents take steps to educate themselves but end up with the wrong information?
Well, that's probably a question that's beyond me. I think it sort of relates to why the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia put out a couple statements in the last few weeks. This was not just Policy Lab, but the leadership across the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. It was informed by at least seven infectious disease specialists. And I think what we recognized as a leading health institution in the region was there is a lot of noise out there, and to try to provide for families an independent voice that could help substantiate a lot of what our local health authorities were seeing, but also help families navigate what the true risk is. And to the previous question about teachers, I mean, certainly we have a lot of empathy for our teachers, our families, particularly in, under resourced school districts, those that may have older infrastructure, greater concerns around ventilation. And I think since the beginning of the pandemic, we've asked those communities to trade off sort of in many ways risks around safety versus risks around education loss and economic security in terms of reliability, being able to get to your jobs. And I think what we're trying to say is you no longer need to treat that risk calculus as equal. And that was an unenviable choice. And what we're reaching now is with the availability of vaccinations and boosters is that's the real intervention. And now with a variant that's been milder, with declining case incidence, you can really focus on getting back to normal and getting kids back to school, and to do it without the anxiety that you had previously because you have other interventions at your disposal. And if you're an individual in those settings who is at higher risk, I certainly support accommodations for those individuals and the availability of tests and trying to help navigate folks in terms of their own level of risk so that they feel safe to Jennifer's points.
Here's another comment, this one from Allie. Jennifer, and I'll put this to you. She says, your guests are missing a vital fact about COVID-19. Every new case is an opportunity for new, possibly new lethal variants. Allie goes on to say mass work in schools to protect teachers and students. As an epidemiologist, is she right?
Well, yes. I mean, variants arise when the virus makes mistakes in copying itself. And the more copies of the virus there are, the more opportunities there are. Now, there are probably some types of patients that are more likely to have an infection that leads to the development of a variant than others. But yes, that's strictly true. But I think we have to zoom out and sort of ask, what is the end game and what are our goals here? And, I see no reasonable path to eliminating this virus from the planet. And so the question is, for how long are we going to maintain measures given the fact that the virus will always be with us? It doesn't mean it's going to be with us at the same levels. And, I expect we're falling into a seasonal pattern. But, the virus that caused the 1918 Great Influenza pandemic circulates every flu season. And, much of this conversation is about, as David rightly pointed out, at what point are we calling for mandatory actions? And at what point do we, shift to a different mode of trying to control the spread that encourages protective behaviors, but that doesn't necessarily make requirements or enact restrictions on everybody.
Well, picking up on that, David Rubin, going back to you, so are we, when you look at the levels, and I realize they vary from region to region, state to state, are we at a endemic level, or are we still at a pandemic level, or is it a mix? How will we know when it's endemic?
Well, certainly, I think it's a little premature to say that it's endemic right now, and that's because we're still seeing the amplitudes here in terms of hospitalizations and the sheer number of people who were infected. We estimated as many as 40% to 50% of individuals may have had Omicron or have been infected with Omicron over the holiday season here. And then certainly a small fraction of that really taxed, really created strain on our hospitals. We will be able to declare more of an endemic state when the amplitude of those waves comes down. They're a little bit more predictable seasonably, and they kind of take on a pattern of our other seasonal viruses, which means there's still going to be some risk to those to more vulnerable members of our society, but it'll be at a rate that's more comparable to what we might see with influenza or other seasonal viruses, and then people will have to make their own individual choices how to navigate those risks.
Well, my understanding is that the national average for the vaccination rate is something like 64%. And if we're talking, Jennifer Nuzzo, about children, if we really want to protect children, should every adult get the vaccination?
Yes. That's probably the single biggest thing we can do to protect children, including those children who are under 5 years of age and not yet eligible to be vaccinated. It's why, you know, I think in this next phase, and I think sometimes it gets portrayed as, you know, we lift the mandates and we no longer care about COVID. And that's very much not true. It's about focusing our efforts and directing our efforts. And I think we have to make sure that we continue to work to improve uptake of vaccines in all age groups, but particularly adults, because of their roles in caring for children who may be too young to be vaccinated, and also because of the risks of severe illness in that group. We also have to focus on the fact there was some data out yesterday about third dose booster doses among people over the age of 65. And, you know, that's, you know, a lot of the hospitalizations is linked to, you know, inadequate protection of that particularly high risk group. So we need to work harder to make sure that people who are particularly at risk of severe illness get their third doses. And I think in all of this conversation, we're talking about everything where I think, you know, we very much need to make sure that the highest priority items for controlling the spread of COVID do not get kind of drowned out in the noise of the debate on around other issues.
Well, to you, David Rubin, I was reading that 175 children have lost a parent or a caring adult over the last 2 years because of COVID. And I mean, what a heartbreaking number that is. And just imagining, I mean, children have been stressed going to school, not going to school, working remotely, being lonely, you know, and now, of course, losing family members. You're a pediatrician, and we're almost up in the second break here, but I just want to sort of pause for a moment to just to remember what children have been living with and going through.
Yeah, there's no way to understate that. And I think it gets to why we had to have a public health emergency and requirements and public orders, you know, earlier on in the pandemic. We shouldn't understate that the risk of an unvaccinated public was, as a very severe virus kind of blew through our communities. And schools were a place where transmission could occur. But, you know, this really started to turn when adults were offered vaccination and later boosters, and certainly once the K-12 students were offered vaccinations. But it helps us remember, you know, why we had to do this and what the risk truly was of you know, infection and transmission moving through families and across generations.
We're talking about kids and COVID today on Radio Times. We'll be talking more about the development of a vaccine for children under the age of 5, talking with David Rubin and Jennifer Nuzzo. And again, you can join us, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guest, Jennifer Nuzzo, who's an epidemiologist, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Also with us is pediatrician David Rubin. He's director of the Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We've been talking about the fact that local governors here in the tri-state area have lifted or are lifting the mask mandate for school children. And I do want to talk some more about the fact that it looks like scientific advisors to the FDA will decide next week whether to greenlight two doses of the Pfizer biotech coronavirus vaccine for children ages 6 months to 4 years. And I wonder, Jennifer Nuzzo, if you could just, I guess, get us up to speed on what's the status of the development of this vaccine for young kids.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I know many parents have been desperately waiting for. And unfortunately, in terms of what we know about the vaccines, we have to wait a bit longer because the data are probably not going to be posted until later the week. We've had some sort of press, you know, comments in the press from the companies, but I'm always hesitant to draw too much inference from that. I think the general status right now is that the companies, you know, some weeks ago announced that the results of the trials, particularly for children ages 2 to 5, did not meet the same measurements that they were hoping for in terms of comparing it to an immune reaction of other age groups. And so they are looking at now what the impact will be of adding a third dose of vaccine to see if that will bring the immune levels up up higher. But those data aren't yet available that we know of. And in the meantime, the FDA has asked the companies to submit their information. There have been rumors that there may be other data. Anyway, I just kind of caution parents and say, let's just wait till we see the information that's made public as the FDA advisory committee gets together to review the data. It is my very sincere hope, given the stakes involved, and given how much parents are hoping to that these vaccines will help them regain their freedom, that we have a very transparent and robust debate about the safety and efficacy of these vaccines before we make any snap decisions about whether they should be used.
David, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I think what's unusual, a little bit unusual in this request is that they're reviewing the first two doses in the context of some of that equivocal data that Jennifer just talked about. I have every reason to believe the safety data will look good, but I think the question that I would raise is if they're testing a third dose right now as a three-dose series, the level of urgency is different now than it would have been, let's say, in September, October, when we knew a seasonal resurgence was about to take hold. I would rather get it right and make sure that we're acting on the best efficacy and safety data. We have time to play this out before next fall, if you will. And so, to me, I would only hope in this process that we are patient enough now, given the moment we're in, to get it right. You know, younger children have a lower risk of disease, and certainly I think building confidence among parents will require us to put the best data forward in order to build that case.
Let me get back to our listeners, and let me also just say a listener thought they heard I said 175 kids who had lost parents or loved ones, and I meant to say 175,000. So I will correct that just to make sure, that's just a shocking number. Here's a comment from King, who says, I'm concerned about the vaccine side effects. Could you guest speak about the vaccine adverse events reporting system and what the results have been so far? And I wonder if Jennifer Nuzzo, can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when people ask that question, they're mostly worried about the long-term effects. And, we generally don't expect, just given the way vaccines work and how quickly they're cleared from your body, that we would see some unknown thing, more than 2 months after a vaccination. There are certainly adverse effects that have been reported immediately following vaccination or within a few weeks following vaccination. They are typically mild. I think the adverse events that have been most worrisome, are things like heart inflammation or blood clots. And, as a general conclusion, the frequency with which those events have happened have been considered to be rare and rarer than we would worry about similar events occurring were people to get infected. I think the question about the VAERS system, it's one that you hear about in the press a lot. It's a very open reporting system, which is meant to be to cast a very wide net to identify potential side effects. So really anybody can report potential adverse events. And, that's both a strength and a weakness of the surveillance system. The strength is that it allows anybody, you don't have to have special access to the CDC in order to be able to report it. But it is a bit of a weakness because we do often see a surge in reports of adverse events following, some cable news host railing about the vaccine. And so it's not always reflective of what people are experiencing. But nonetheless, it's been a valuable surveillance system to look at. And all of what we know about the safety, incredible safety of these vaccines, does take into account the reports that are submitted through that system.
David Rubin, here's a question from Melanie. Can you talk about the worry of long-term problems with COVID in children, even if they have slight or even no symptoms when they first get sick? Do we know how common long COVID is for children?
You know, it still remains controversial, and certainly that remains one of those uncertain areas in terms of long-term consequences. With earlier strains of the virus, there's certainly been reports of secondary complications. There's been reports of the development of diabetes, for example, in some children. But here's what gives us a little bit of confidence. It's not perfect. I mean, certainly we're going to be studying the impacts of COVID for a long time, but during this current wave with the Omicron, we actually proportionally saw a far less children with the inflammatory condition that we saw early on in children. And if you believe a lot of the long-term COVID is related to the inflammatory response that's produced as a result of infection, seeing those rates of MISC really decline compared to prior waves, to me, is reassuring. And the mild, the relatively milder illness in most children would also support that as well. So you have to suspect that the likelihood of long COVID-related concerns is actually going down.
Once we know the, especially for the real wee ones, the really little children, that is safe. David, should we have vaccine mandates for schools the way we do for chickenpox or polio or hepatitis B or diphtheria or measles, mumps, and rubella? Should that just be, you know, part of what parents should expect for their children?
You know, certainly I think that this is going to be obviously a debate that comes up in advance of the next school year, but I'm still a little bit cautious about going that far. Certainly in our healthcare systems, I think it's extremely important. The margin for error, particularly with immunocompromised patients and those with serious health conditions, requires that we be very careful in terms of how we staff our healthcare systems. But, you know, as we await further data on the durability of immunity from natural infection, as we await further information about subsequent strains and whether they'll be more virulent or not, I think there's a lot of information that will come to bear in that debate. And right now it feels a little bit more like it's moving in the direction of, let's say, influenza than it is, you know, measles. If this is going to be an endemic virus, there's going to be significant recommendations for the public to get vaccinated, maybe boosted on occasion, but whether that rises to the level of mandates, I think, are going to be individual discussions that are had in state governor offices and legislatures.
Here's a kind of a broad question based on some of the things I see on my screen here to you, Jennifer Nuzzo, for parents who are, you know, they're just on the fence about a vaccine for their children, and the vaccination for children that have been approved is relatively low. I mean, broadly speaking, how do you convince a skeptical parent that it's okay, it's safe to vaccinate their children for COVID, against COVID?
Yeah, so I never set out to try to convince. I just try to talk to them about what they're concerned about and try to offer information that might put them at more at ease, perhaps. I will tell you, my views of the vaccine is that I consider it free insurance against a possible rare outcome, and I'm happy to have one less thing to worry about. I, over the holidays, our family went on an international trip, and I felt much more comfortable doing that given the fact that we were all vaccinated. So for our family, it has contributed to greater freedoms and fewer worries. I will tell you, so I view it as free insurance. I don't see the downside of it, in part because I believe these vaccines, and you know, we've seen now with the literally billions of people who have been vaccinated, how incredibly safe they are. I think when parents are on the fence, it's either because, as I said before, they're worried about some yet to be found long-term consequences of the vaccines. And again, we really don't expect that these vaccines are taken up by just a few cells in your arm and they're out of your body in a few weeks. So we just don't expect that to happen. There's not really a biological plausibility that would happen. Or they think that it's just not necessary, that they would rather kind of roll the dice and see what happens. And, you know, that's a harder thing to address, other than the fact that I have to point out that nobody is going to kind of be able to weather the storm and come out when the sky is clear. This virus is going to be with us forever. And, you know, it's likely all of us are going to encounter it at some point in our lives, possibly multiple times in our lives. And I personally would rather go into that fight with some level of protection than not.
So that's the new normal, that it's here to stay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's an email from Steph. I'll put this to you, David Rubin. My daughter had COVID for a week in March and was fine. She got her second vaccine in November and developed myocarditis 10 days after. She also has something called POTS. Doctors seem so preoccupied with promoting vaccination, they're not working on helping those who have been injured by vaccines. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think it would be remiss of me to discuss an individual case there. I mean, certainly there are rare complications, and I would just point back to, you know, certainly for that particular child, I hope the child's receiving care, and I suspect the child is. But what I would say is that, you know, there were some very clear studies, despite the low risk of myocarditis, and it was extremely low from the vaccine. There were other studies that demonstrated the risk of myocarditis to be as high as 1-2% with earlier strains of the COVID virus. So, you know, to me, there's always a trade-off of risks that people have to make. And like Jennifer said, you know, the vaccine really took the teeth out of this virus and allowed many people to kind of resume their lives in a way, recognizing that the risk for some of these outcomes were very much reduced with regards to once they received the vaccine and the protection it conferred.
Jennifer, I'm looking actually at a headline from the New York Times. The U.S. has far higher COVID death rates than other wealthy countries. First of all, is that true? And what does that tell us about either our healthcare system or the health of our fellow Americans?
Yeah, I mean, it tells us a lot. So, yes, the United States has reported, the highest number of deaths. And it's a little bit hard when we look on the global level because being able to diagnose COVID and to diagnose deaths is not a capacity that all countries have equal access to or do with the same level. And if you look at other measures of how hard countries may have been hit by COVID, something called excess deaths, which is less dependent on testing, the country orders restack a bit. But just comparing the United States to other high-income countries, that's a little bit more instructive because there's more similarities there.
Sure.
And one of the things that becomes very clear when you look at that comparison is not just how high the U.S. ranks in terms of deaths, but then how low we rank in terms of vaccination coverage. So we really have a lot more work to do in terms of particularly vaccinating adults and making sure, we can defang this virus as much as possible and take off the table its ability to put people in the hospital or kill them. And we just haven't done enough vaccinations. We haven't done enough to add additional protection to people who are over the age of 65, who may have only gotten two doses. There's just more we can do to reduce deaths. I think in this next phase, when our case numbers are low, that allows us to focus more with greater precision on the measures that above all matter most in terms of preventing deaths.
Let me squeeze in one more comment. I'll put this to you, David Rubin. Margaret says, I heard a public health expert point out that the burden of falling ill while working in essential services falls disproportionately on people of color. For the sake of social equity, she urged that masking in schools continue until the rates of hospitalization and death fall further. Can you speak to her concern?
Well, you know, I think the equity piece has been extremely important. I think I mentioned before, you know, we're particularly, you know, we should particularly recognize how, communities, particularly black and brown communities, folks who live in the city, people who live in under-resourced community or low-income communities, all of the above, that they have had the unenviable choice, particularly earlier in this pandemic, in choosing between risk of personal safety to their families and multi-generational households, versus the risk of not being able to get to work or their educational loss in their children. But my concern now is the discussion around equity is being tied up with equity being exclusively defined as about safety. Safety is certainly very important. And I think as this COVID pandemic recedes, we should be mindful there are issues with the aging infrastructure of our schools, The ventilation in our schools, the concerns that our teachers have expressed throughout it, that need be addressed. And we should hold our public officials accountable for assuring that we don't forget about those things. But at the same time, these choices are not necessarily equal at this point, particularly as the virulence of this virus has decreased, as case incidence starts to come down, as people are now offered interventions in terms of vaccination and boosters. And so therefore, the competing risks, and particularly around educational loss and economic security, which themselves are real equity concerns, are important too. And I guess that arrives at sort of an opinion that, you know, when you think about equity, equity is about allowing people to have
choices.
Oh,
boy, I hate to do this, David. We're really running out of time here.
Yeah, can I just make this final point just real quick?
You got 5 seconds.
Yeah, just 5 seconds. This is that equity is about people's choices to praise their own risks. Because people have their own challenges, and I think that's important as we start to shift to this.
Well, we
got to
leave it there. David Rubin, Jennifer Nuzzo, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.